loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In this hour, we take a look at several big stories in our regular Friday segment called The Week in Review. Today, we talk about the ongoing situation in Venezuela, the power of labor and teachers' recent successes, and the new announcement that 200 so-called peacekeeping U.S. troops will now stay in Syria.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. Israeli soldiers killed a 14-year-old Palestinian today. The Palestinian Health Ministry spokesman said the boy was shot in the chest during demonstrations to the east of Gaza City. The Great March of Return started almost a year ago with protests every Friday since March 30th, 2018. Cuban residents are voting on Sunday for a new constitution. The vote follows a series of open community meetings where residents debated and amended the constitutional proposals. The last constitution was written in 1976, and more than 6 million people are registered to vote on Sunday. Congressional Democrats today released a resolution of disapproval aimed at President Trump's declaration of a national emergency. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said that it will be voted on in the House on Tuesday, where it's expected to sail through due to the Democratic majority. The Republican-controlled Senate will be more difficult and may not even come up for a vote, with just one Republican coming out to support it so far, that's Senator Susan Collins from Maine. Those are today's headlines. You are listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the big stories of the week. In this, our Friday segment called The Week in Review, we'll spend the first hour talking about the big stories of the week. We'll talk about politics, policy, and international affairs with Jim Kavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net, whose most recent article is The Siege of Venezuela and the Travails of Empire. And we're also joined in studio by Walter Smolarek. Walter is a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show. Jim, Walter, welcome back.
Happy to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Jim, you wrote an article, The Siege of Venezuela. Today there was, or last night, I can't quite tell, there was military clashes at the Brazil-Venezuela border. What's going on?
It's very dangerous. And this business tomorrow is you know, looking as a setup for bad news.
What is this business?
the dueling concerts, the Live Aid-ish Branson, isn't that tomorrow, Saturday? And the attempt, the Richard Branson's Live Aid-ish concert, I don't know who he's getting for that, and they're going to be attempts to get through the border with the American, quote-unquote, humanitarian aid. I also read something a couple of days ago. There was an attack on Venezuelan oil drilling facilities or oil production facilities that was very dangerous. You know, and I think this thing tomorrow has, you know, you'd have to be kind of masochistic to attend this concert, because there's a high chance of the famous snipers appearing and shooting a couple of people and creating a provocation. They're looking for a provocation to instigate military action, but I don't know what good it's going to do them. It's a very dangerous situation. The United States and the Guaido forces haven't really gotten very far, except with, you know, declarations from friendly countries, and they have to force the issue and try and break the Maduro government's hold and sovereignty and create a situation where they start controlling the borders. And I don't know how they're going to do it without creating serious military conflict.
Yeah, you know, I think what Jim referenced about the snipers is very important. What we're talking about there is the 2002, the April 11, 2002 coup attempt against Hugo Chavez, where the opposition set up or, you know, hired or, you know, recruited snipers to shoot at their own marchers at an opposition demonstration to kill people and make it seem, you know, through the manipulation of media footage, to make it seem like it was supporters of President Chavez and the Bolivarian Revolution who were carrying out those acts of violence. And then that became the pretext for a coup d'etat. And the announcement of that coup d'etat, by the way, back in 2002, was pre-recorded. They knew what was going to happen. They said, you know, this is the last straw. They did that before this whole setup. So early this morning, I think something similar to that is what happened earlier this morning. So this is the opposition's official story. It's completely ludicrous. So what they're saying is that a unit of the Bolivarian National Guard, so the country's National Guard, one of the main security forces, rolled up to this checkpoint that was set up by indigenous people. Everybody was unarmed. All the indigenous protesters were unarmed. But the National Guard soldiers pulled out assault rifles and just started mowing everybody down. And so one person was killed and 12 people were injured. But the indigenous people then were in a fury and they rallied and they chased off these heavily armed men who had just like shot a ton of people. So, don't go looking for evidence or trying to confirm a troop presence in the area because everyone's been chased away already. So, I mean, there's a significant sort of like fog of war type thing going on here where we can't know exactly what's true and what's not, but it just sounds so ludicrous.
Wait a second. That doesn't sound like the fog of war. That sounds like a staged provocation.
Yeah.
Which is different. That's an actual manipulation. John, manipulations are common.
Oh, very common. In fact, they're sort of written into the script. Whenever you're doing an operation, whether it's a military operation or an intelligence one, you have plan A, plan B, and plan C. One of those is what you're going to implement. And they all have a provocation in them because it's the provocation that helps you get to your goal. And the goal here is to influence public opinion.
In 1964, there's something Jim Cavanaugh called the Gulf of Tonkin incident. Yeah. Let's talk about that.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, well, it's the same. And, you know, what Walter was talking about, which did happen, and it's important to note, it happened in Venezuela already. But it's also what happened in Ukraine, in the Maidan. Snipers appeared. And they're still... The Ukraine government is actually at this point stonewalling on the investigation because they know these snipers were not from the government. They were hired from outside forces. It happened in Syria. Snipers appeared. Snipers are always, a favorite tactic right now. The provocation of the Gulf of Tonkin, sure. Like the blowing up of the Maine in the harbor for the Spanish-American War. I mean, this is classic false flag and provocations that, you create a situation which you can blame on your target government or your target, and, what the Germans did in Poland, send a couple of soldiers across the border and shoot them, so this is what's got to have to happen for the United States to push the issue and create what they think will be something to their advantage, put the conflict on the military terrain where they think they have an advantage. Of course, we're going to have to see about that. They haven't gotten the Venezuelan military to budge yet, and it's going to be very difficult. It's a very tense situation. But if the U.S. goes home after tomorrow without having gotten any aid through, and the Guaido forces look like they just had this phony festival with Richard Branson and nothing happens, it's going to be very bad. It's going to look bad for them. They don't want that to happen.
Yeah, that's really it. I mean, when everybody's going to the border, Marco Rubio, who's like the chief cheerleader of this operation, he's down there. Sir Richard Branson, who I don't know, does he believe that he can be knighted also in Venezuela? Like he can just, I don't get... It's the We Are the World for counter-revolutionaries.
Exactly. What a great song for that.
Yeah, We Are the World. We intend to be the world. You won't be independent. You won't be free. Sir Richard Branson has proclaimed, along with Mike Pence and John Bolton, who the leaders of Venezuela will be. The Gulf of Tonkin, by the way, to remind our listeners, or those who may be, like Walter, too young, not yet born, in fact, to have experienced it, in 1964, in August, the Johnson administration reported to the country that these North Vietnamese patrol boats or small torpedo boats had attacked the USS Maddox, like a big U.S. destroyer. They pursued them, these like small North Vietnamese boats, and they fired on them, and the U.S. retaliated and killed like four or five North Vietnamese sailors. And then that was used as the justification because of this aggression by North Vietnam against America, against the USS Maddox, for the Johnson administration to order the sending of 400,000 U.S. soldiers to Vietnam.
465,000.
465,000. That's when the Vietnam War went from one stage to another stage.
Oh, yeah. There's no turning back by then.
There's no turning back. And so then between 1964 with this, it turns out these were, they call them, when you look at Wikipedia, everybody, or do some of your own research, they're called ghost boats, meaning boats that didn't exist from North Vietnam. Again, 58,000 Americans died. Hundreds of thousands had life-changing wounds. Many suffered post-traumatic stress for the rest of their lives. And maybe as many as 2 million Vietnamese died. And the thing was based on a lie. It was a provocation. It wasn't true. The U.S. government had decided to escalate its war against Vietnam because it was losing, just like the U.S. is losing in the coup against Maduro in Venezuela. So their conclusion is not to pull back. Their conclusion is to escalate. That's what is about to happen.
And the horrible thing here is the way the media is just playing along with this. It is like Hearst in the Spanish-American one. This is the yellow press. That's an even older reference. But, you know, the media has drummed this up, this nonsense about humanitarian aid, that Maduro is blocking humanitarian aid. Humanitarian aid is coming in from all around the world. The only aid that Maduro is blocking is that which is being brought in by Elliot Abrams, convicted smuggler of arms in humanitarian aid packages. And, you know, he's trying to...
Self-admitted.
Yeah. He said it was by the book. It's all right, because it was by the book, by the American's book. And, you know, so this is really complete nonsense. And they keep throwing this picture up of the Tiendras Bridge, and, you know, which is all just debunked nonsense. But they are, the media has created or are in the process of manufacturing popular consent for this, which you can do. It doesn't last once the shooting starts and people start getting killed. But by then, then you got national honor at stake and you can't back down and da-ga-da-ga-da. And this is what's happening. It's very dangerous.
Yeah, you know, I mean, let's just think through logically what we're being asked to believe today, right? Which is what, you know, we're considering could be the possible beginning of a true all-out U.S. war on Venezuela to effect regime change. You know, the sanctions didn't break the army. You know, all of this political and diplomatic pressure didn't result in a coup. Maybe they're going for a bombing campaign now. Maybe they're going for something more serious. Let's think about
what's important.
Yeah, let's think about what we're being asked to believe here. Okay, so the government of Venezuela knows that the one thing that can actually make the opposition take power, that can lead to their victory and his overthrow, is if somebody is shot in this whole stage provocation around the, you know, aid being, quote unquote, aid being led into the country. It's obvious that this has been the focal point of, you know, all the hostile corporate press. It's been the focal point of John Bolton, of all the regime change backers in Washington. The very last thing that they would do under these circumstances is to send a unit of the National Guard, not armed with crowd control weapons, by the way, but exclusively armed, apparently, with assault rifles, with live ammunition, to go into this area that's not even that important, right? I mean, it's along the Brazil-Venezuela border, but in a remote area, and just start shooting people randomly, shooting unarmed people for no reason. I mean, how does that make any sense? I mean, isn't it much more reasonable to believe that this is a provocation designed by the people who know that something like this is the only possible way that they can succeed in their goal?
And it has this added benefit. If it's Venezuelan military fighting Yankee imperialism, or even the fascist Bolsonaro, it looks like, for progressive people, justice might be on the side of the Venezuelans. But if the event happens in an area where there's indigenous people, then it looks like the Venezuelan government attacking native indigenous people. Now, John, you'll remember, because we're talking about Elliot Abrams, the Iran-Contra, sending weapons to the Contras.
Yep.
The Contras were, by for everybody who don't know, they were the demobilized National Guardsmen who are the National Guard of Somoza's brutal dictatorship. You can't get more anti-democratic and more dictatorial than Somoza, Anastasio Somoza.
Yep, absolutely brutal. Comparable to the Shah of Iran with his internal security force.
A Nazi-like sort of regime.
Correct.
So while the U.S. is trying to topple the Sandinistas who dared to overthrow the Somoza dictatorship, which was in the pocket of the United States, Elliot Abrams and the Reagan administration sent billions of dollars of arms to Contras. These were the opponents. They were against the Sandinista government. At a certain point, they also organized the Indian indigenous population, some part of it.
Which most Americans don't know.
Yeah. And then the Sandinistas, when they were fighting some parts of the indigenous community who were being influenced by the U.S. imperialist intervention against the Sandinistas, then it looked like the Sandinistas were not fighting Yankee imperialism. They were fighting their own indigenous people. So they appeared to be the oppressors I mean, this is the same playbook that's being used again in Venezuela. I think it's got Elliot Abrams written all over it.
And I can't help but to think now in retrospect that this is exactly why Elliot Abrams was brought into the administration in the first place. We know from McCabe's new book that nearly 2 years ago in a cabinet meeting, Trump said, specifically referencing Venezuela, "Now that's the country we should invade. They have all that oil." Well, that's exactly what this is about.
Yeah, go ahead, Jim Kavanaugh.
No, that was the Miskito Indians, I believe they were called, M-I-S-K-I-T-O.
Nicaragua, that's correct.
In Nicaragua, yeah. And this is you know, this is a playbook. And what other talents does Elliot Abrams have? I mean, what were his qualifications for the job? Those are his qualifications, that he ran that same kind of play, which is what it is, kind of staged play, in Nicaragua. So it is what they're trying to do again. And, you know, it's just, but, you know, when you think about it, what Walter says, also think logically about what the results of this could be. I mean, even if the United States could start a conflict, even if they could depose the government of Maduro, if you're going to do that with proxy forces from Colombia, because they would have to use them, it can't just be complete American forces, a bombing campaign doesn't make any sense whatsoever. You have to depose the government. The result of that is going to be a situation in Venezuela where you're going to have serious reactionary fascist violence against all these working class institutions that the Chavista revolution has set up. This is going to go on for years. You're going to have a situation where the people in Haiti is already, nobody's paying any attention to that, but the Haitians are already protesting against their government, partly because they are allying with the United States against Venezuela. And if the Colombians get involved in this, there have already been Colombian rebel groups who said, we will fight the Colombian government if they attack Venezuela. You're going to have throughout Latin America a lot of people who are going to see this as what it is, naked Yankee imperialism all over again. You're going to disrupt the political and social and military atmosphere all throughout Latin America. This isn't going to, you're not just going to walk in and say, oh, Maduro leaves and we take over, everything's going to be hunky-dory from now on. You're creating another situation of a kind of semi-failed state that's going to disrupt the entire region. I don't know what they think they're going to get away with. How they think they're going to get away with this? Who thinks through these things?
121 years ago, the United States became a colony-seeking empire in earnest. And that was with the Spanish-American War.
That's right. And that's what got us both Cuba and the Philippines. We made a conscious decision to create an empire.
And Puerto Rico.
And Puerto Rico.
And right before that, a part of the country of Colombia was stolen so that this new thing called Panama could be created, through which the United States could build a canal. So the U.S. seized Cuba. It seized Puerto Rico. It seized really a part of Colombia to build a canal linking America's industrial East Coast to Asia through a trade route, because otherwise you'd have to go all the way down to the bottom of South America to bring American products. That was too expensive. And the U.S. invaded the Philippines. 1 million Filipinos died. People don't know that was the number. Now, in the United States at the time, there was a split. There was a division among the elites, among the economic establishment, between industrial capital, the National Association of Manufacturers, those who wanted to be colonialists. They said they wanted to be imperialists. It wasn't like a bad word. It wasn't a pejorative. And then there were the anti-imperialists, and those were the parts of the economic elites who were focused more on the home market, light industry, etc. And there became an anti-imperialist movement in the United States. Who led that movement? Mark Twain. W.E.B. Du Bois. It was a huge movement. It was tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. People don't know about this in American history. Now, at the time, there was so much opposition to the war, so much opposition to the U.S. becoming that kind of an empire, that what Jim referred to earlier as yellow journalism, that was the Hearst family, William Randolph Hearst, San Francisco Chronicle, the rest of the newspaper world. You remember Jim Kavanaugh, and of course, John Kiriakou, you will remember, and Walter, again, I just don't know if you'll remember this. William Randolph Hearst sent Frederick Remington, the photographer, to Cuba to take pictures of the war. And then Remington wrote back to William Randolph Hearst, and this is very famous. Everybody should know this about American history. he gets there to take pictures of the war, and he telegraphs back to William Randolph Hearst, and he says, "Everything is quiet. There is no trouble. There will be no war. I wish to return." That's an exact quote. That's his telegram. To which Hearst responds, "Please remain. You furnish the pictures, and I'll furnish the war." And that's what happened. Because then we had the explosion of the battleship Maine, the U.S. Maine, in the harbor of Havana. There's great big depictions in all William Randolph Hearst newspapers of this, of American sailors dying, and Spain bombed the boat.
Yep.
And the fact of the matter is, before the first American soldier arrived in Cuba to liberate Cuba from Spain, because that was the mission then, right? That was the announced mission. Before that happened, guess what? Spain surrendered. But the troops weren't told the war happened, even though Spain surrendered, because the real goal of the war was for the U.S. to acquire those colonies. And of course, they had to give it a noble cause. We're going to help Cuban independence against the Spanish Empire.
And this was part of essentially an extension of the Monroe Doctrine, which was issued in the early 1800s by the U.S. President Monroe. And it was couched in the language of national self-determination and sovereignty and opposition to imperialism. But what it effectively said is that Europe, you're not allowed to have colonies in Latin America because Latin America is ours. Latin America is essentially a colony, a big colony of the United States, and anything that happens in this hemisphere, in the Western Hemisphere, will be determined by us and not by you. And so, you know, in the early part of the 2000s, right, from 1998, when Hugo Chavez was elected up until, you know, we saw things unfortunately turn to the right in the past few years, you know, Latin America had been asserting a historic level of independence and unity. Progressive governments were elected in almost every single country in the region. You know, there was Lula in Brazil, there were the Kirchners in Argentina, Evo Morales in Bolivia is still in office, there's Bachelet in Chile, there's, you know, all these different Rafael Correa in Ecuador, all these different progressive leaders who were, you know, different shades of the left, right? They weren't all as radical as the process that was going on in Venezuela, but they basically banded together and said they created institutions like the Union of South American Nations, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, you know, all of these institutions that basically said, hey, Latin America is for Latin Americans, not for the United States. And this, what's going on in Venezuela, is sort of the last push to reverse all of that progress, right? You know, there's a semi-fascist government in Brazil, right? The extreme right-wing semi-fascist government in Colombia, all these other conservative governments completely pro-Washington. And Venezuela is seen as sort of, along with Cuba and also Nicaragua, is seen as sort of the last holdouts. Bolivia, I think, is also on their hit list. And so what they want to do is turn the clock back to the early 1800s when the United States issued the Monroe Doctrine and said, we determine everything that happens in this continent.
Yeah, and that was explicitly what Bill Maher said, where he complained about, this is our backyard. This is our backyard. This is backyard imperialism. You know, it's a little bit embarrassing, though, at the moment. We're supposed to be beyond that. You know, and this isn't going to go down well in Latin America, whatever the leaders of country X or country Y say, whatever fascist leader of Brazil says, people aren't going to like this. And it's embarrassing for the Europeans to be going along with this. This is blatant colonialism and imperialism of the kind that all these European liberal and social democratic parties, you know, should be horrified at. Justin Trudeau, whose father was a friend of Fidel Castro. I mean, it's horrible that these governments are going along with this. And it shows what poodles they are for the Americans. And it also, as you say, Brian, I mean, they used the language of self-determination for blatant imperialism during the Spanish-American War. And now they're using the language of democracy and humanitarianism. I mean, you can't do this unless you have the press, the media, this whole barrage of propaganda that just distorts these words and turns them into something else. You know, somehow Maduro is a dictator, even though his opponent, who's calling for a foreign intervention and running around the country and declaring himself the president, trying to depose the democratically elected president, is running around free giving press conferences. If there's one thing Maduro has failed at, it's being a dictator. You know, the opposition has like 70% of the press and up to 70% of the public. They have press. They run around saying whatever they want. And, you know, so that's dictatorship. And putting the guy in who didn't get a single vote is democracy. And talk about the pictures, you know, that picture of that bridge, which is still being sent around by on by CNN and the establishment press is just phony. And that's what's being used to pound into people's minds, that Maduro is blocking aid, humanitarian aid. It's just, it's horrible. This is yellow press journalism at its worst.
People are being deliberately misled by the U.S. corporate-owned media. It's deliberate. Again, John, you and I have talked about that helicopter protest headline in the Washington Post.
Oh, that's one of the most egregious that we've seen.
Now, you would think, like, because here again, it's about what the American people are being deliberately misled.
Mm-hmm.
The headline, I'm looking at it, it's from June 27th, 2017. So it's about a little less than 2 years ago, 18 months ago. Headline, Washington Post, helicopter used for protest flight against Maduro, heightening Venezuelan tensions. Okay, there was a helicopter. You think, okay, maybe the helicopter had a banner on it that said, we support new elections or something like that, because it was a helicopter used for a protest. In the 10th paragraph, you find out that the helicopter, the form of its protest was to drop bombs on the Supreme Court. I mean, that's in the 10th paragraph. And then to the extent that the Venezuelan government doesn't think it's a good idea for helicopters to fly over government buildings and drop bombs on it, the Venezuelan government is called repressive against dissenters. Again, you can't get more egregious in the deliberate misleading of the American people. At our Supreme Court, you know, 16 blocks from here, you can't even walk onto the patio with a banner.
Nope.
You'll be arrested. But here, it's okay for helicopters. Hijacked helicopter to drop grenades on top of the Supreme Court. That's just a form of protest. I mean, this is the kind of deliberate misleading information. There's another headline from today in the New York Times. Venezuela's ex-spy chief breaks with Maduro. Quote, you have killed hundreds. And then there's a picture of Maduro standing with Hugo Caraval. Now, what it makes the reader think is that Maduro's inner, you know, core leadership is breaking apart and there's this big defection, right? And this guy says Maduro killed hundreds. Well, again, you get down to it's the 9th paragraph. You find out that this guy hasn't been with any intelligence service in Venezuela since 2012. That was 7 years ago. That he's a sanctioned individual for drug trafficking. That he was, in fact, involved in drug trafficking, according to his own admission, that he's liable to be indicted by the United States for drug trafficking. But instead of being a drug trafficker, he's now a hero because he has broken from Maduro. Again, this is misleading. I've shown this article to people all morning, asking them, what do you think about this article? And they kind of don't notice the fact that in the 10th paragraph, he admits to being a sanctioned and probably indicted drug trafficker. Amazing.
But this demonization, you know, this demonization is actually essential because all of the months leading up to today's what appears by all indications to be a staged provocation along the Venezuelan-Brazilian border, all of this is necessary for people to swallow the final big lie at the end, because the only way that this story makes sense that we've been talking about, that, you know, National Guard soldiers started basically randomly shooting at indigenous people with assault rifles, the only way that could possibly make sense is if you think that Nicolas Maduro is evil, he's motivated exclusively by evil, he's doing just cartoonishly evil things that are even negative for his own rule, because that's just who he is. And he's the embodied, you know, the demonization campaign is absolutely essential if people are going to swallow this story that we're being fed today.
Yeah, you have to demonize the targeted entity so people buy the line, hook, line, and sinker that the U.S. intervention is justified, just as it was in Cuba in 1898 and in Puerto Rico. And of course, Puerto Rico today, still a colony. Anyway, we're going to leave it there. We're taking a short break. And after that short break, we'll come back to talk about the other big stories of the week. Stay tuned.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's time for our weekly segment, The Week in Review. This is the second half of this segment where we talk about the week in politics, policy, and international affairs with Jim Kavanaugh. Jim is the editor of thepolemicist.net. His most recent article is The Siege of Venezuela and the Travails of Empire. We're also joined in studio by Walter Smolarek, Sputnik News analyst. Welcome back, guys.
Glad to be here.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Jim Kavanaugh, Bernie Sanders has announced a 2020 bid. He immediately got enormous amounts of small donations. I think like $6 million.
$5.4 million.
5.4?
Today I saw 5.7.
Yeah.
In the first 24 hours.
First 24 hours.
And I saw 5.9.
Yeah, there you go.
Walter wants a new job as a fact checker. That's why my point was he raised a lot of money. Almost $6 million in small donations, about $27. And again, Sanders is coming out with a very, I would say, different program compared to the other candidates. And of course, there's a lot of them. What's your take, Jim Kavanaugh?
Well, I think Sanders has shown that he's still very popular. He's scaring the hell out of the Democratic Party again. You know, he did raise almost $6 million, between $5 and $6 million, way outstripping anybody else, including Kamala Harris. And he's sticking to his Medicare for All, free college tuition, public college tuition. You know, he's got a strong social democratic welfare state, FDR. He invoked FDR last night on Chris Hayes, saying this is what FDR asked for. You know, healthcare is a human right. Jobs is a human right. So this is something that's going to be very popular. He's already pushed a lot of Democrats into those positions, and he's going to push them to either stick with those positions or back away. A lot of them are backing away. But he's going to be very popular. And I don't know what the Democrats want to do about it. I don't know if you saw that hit piece in Politico this morning from Florida about Bernie Sanders will never be the Democratic nominee because of his stance on Venezuela.
I read that, yeah.
Because he refused to recognize Guaido. Now, I tend to think that Bernie Sanders' position on Venezuela is insufficient, to say the least. But and, you know, he's not taking a strong anti-imperialist stance. He's taking a soft anti-intervention stance, which is something else. But it's much leagues better than most other candidates, except for Tulsi Gabbard. I think he and Tulsi Gabbard are going to be flies in the ointment of the Democratic Party's attempt to nominate, to crown another nominee that nobody's supposed to be able to criticize, which right now looks like they want it to be Kamala Harris. But there's too much discontent among the Democratic Party constituency. People are PO'd, and they're not going to go along with stuff with another Clintonite campaign of centrism and let's win over centrist voters and let's not push for too much. And Medicare for All is an aspiration we'll get to some 20 years down the road. But right now, let's fiddle around on the edges with Obamacare. And a lot of people are not going to go along with, we will shut up about American interventions in Venezuela as long as we get some kind of tax hike on the wealthy. So there's going to be discontent, and people are going to be at each other's throats in the Democratic Party, and that's a good thing. The Democratic Party is going to be demonstrating again, from my position, that it's a reactionary party, that it's not part of the solution, but it's part of the problem. And Bernie Sanders' problem, from my position, is that from my perspective, is that he is going, at the end of the day, to go along with whatever the Democrats try to give us.
Does that mean if he doesn't get the nomination, he's going to support whoever the Democrat is? Or are you suggesting...
Yes.
Okay, I got that one. But are you suggesting he's going to go along with something else? In other words, a centrist-dictated program of the Democratic Party?
Well, no. I mean, he'll do what he's always done. He'll criticize that. He'll present his own ideas. He'll say we have to, but he'll put those on the back burner for the sake of getting the Democratic Party.
Let me ask you this as a follow-up, and I want to ask John and Walter, because it's electoral season, which means banality is in.
Yep.
Superficiality is in. Prognostication is in. I want to talk about what this might mean. I mean, if you look at the field right now, let's say there's 15 Democrats.
Yep.
And Bernie Sanders is clearly the most popular among them. And he may be the most popular politician in the country, right?
Yeah, he very well could be.
So if the others split the vote, then Bernie Sanders is the nominee. He wins, right? What Jim Kavanaugh is saying, though, is that the Democratic Party is not willing to accept Bernie Sanders or his program, especially his program. Thus, will, in spite of his popularity, Bernie Sanders be defeated as he was in 2016?
Well, I think that's entirely possible. And it's because even though there has been quote unquote reform vis-a-vis superdelegates, we don't really know yet what that reform has been. So we may again end up in a position like we did in West Virginia, where Bernie Sanders won the West Virginia primary and Hillary Clinton won all 45 delegates.
I remember that scene from it's Fahrenheit 119, Michael Moore's movie. The West Virginian, they have all 55 is on their placard because Bernie Sanders not only won the state, he won every county.
Yeah, every county.
All 55 counties, and Hillary Clinton still won the state.
Yeah.
I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, it's amazing. And I think even beyond sort of the machinery of the Democratic Party, the corporate media might be decisive in this, or at least, you know, they'll pose a serious threat to Bernie Sanders' campaign. I mean, Jim was referencing that hit piece in Politico. There have been so many hit pieces in almost every major outlet since he announced or even running up to his announcement to try to dissuade him from declaring his candidacy. So I think that, you know, like we saw, I mean, in 2016 it was a little bit different because there was initially it was like a media blackout on his campaign. And then once the rallies started getting really huge, they couldn't really ignore him. And then they settled on a couple different lines of attack. But now I think the corporate media is much more prepared. They kind of know what the line, you know, the anti-Sanders arguments are that they're going to use. And they're prepared. And so, you know, Sanders also, I mean, beyond the fundraising, I thought even maybe even more impressive was that like 600,000 people signed up to be, you know, like active volunteers for his campaign. He said his goal was 1 million.
That's in like
24 hours. Yeah, unbelievable. So, I mean, there's going to be a ton of grassroots energy behind this campaign, I think. And then that's the question. Will the power of the corporate media be able to dissipate some of that energy or will it stand strong?
Bernie Sanders himself has to stand up for those people. You know, a lot of people wanted Bernie Sanders after the convention to run as a third party. But this time especially, if people look at you talked about the West Virginia primary, but Bernie Sanders, it's almost impossible to avoid the conclusion that he was seriously cheated in the primaries in the southern states, in the Super Tuesday primaries, where Hillary Clinton won. And this goes to the whole American electoral system and how bad it is, these electronic voting machines. Hillary Clinton won, you know, way beyond the polling in every state that had direct recording electronic voting machines. She beat Bernie Sanders by, you know, 10 and 15% more than the polling showed, the last poll showed, or the exit poll showed. And she gathered on that day a huge number of delegates that really couldn't ever be overcome. And unless Bernie Sanders is willing to criticize and use the energy and enthusiasm he does have behind him against the machinations of the Democratic Party and the American elect, if he's willing to accept these kinds of things, if he's willing to accept being cheated out of primaries and being cheated out of delegates, then he's going to lose. And what is he doing to the people behind him if he does that? You know, he didn't complain about that. He didn't make the stink about that. He should have. He has the constituency. Either he uses it, and he's got to use it, that means against the Democratic Party too, which is going after him, and which is a reactionary ruling class party, or he doesn't. And at the end of the day, he's just a sheepdog for them. And he's doing it in order to keep all those enthusiastic people in the process to vote in the electoral process as it is, without really challenging it too much. And at the end of the day, make sure that the Republican, that is Trump, doesn't win.
Yeah, I've been seeing a lot, too, a lot of comments, whether on Twitter, Facebook, whatever, people saying, I like Bernie, or I like Kamala, or I like this one, or that one, or the other one. But no matter what happens, and no matter who the nominee is, I'm voting for the nominee, and I'm not going to criticize any Democrat because it's too important to defeat Donald Trump. And I don't remember hearing that in previous elections.
I mean, I think we heard it and to some extent, because let's go back to what Jim is actually saying. I think his points are extremely, really important points. It's the question not only of how Bernie Sanders is being screwed, but how, if Bernie Sanders does not stand up for the people who are standing up for him and for the ideas, at the moment that he's being cheated and thus they are being cheated by the establishment, then you have to wonder what are his real goals? What are his real objectives? Again, I was sort of struck when I recently saw that movie Fahrenheit 119, referring to a November 9th, the day after Trump wins office, a Michael Moore movie. It was Bernie Sanders who goes to the mic when the election is still contested, the primary, the Democratic nomination. But it's clear now he's going to lose because he's even lost West Virginia, where he won all 55 counties. He says something like, "I move to suspend the rules and I nominate Hillary Rodham Clinton to be the next president of the United States." And the place cheers, except the Moore's cameras pan to the Sanders supporters. They're crying because they weren't in this just to make the Democrats be the victor in November. They were fighting for change. They were fighting for more than just a victory in November. They were fighting for change. The Democratic Party establishment then said to all of them and to everyone, guess what? If you care about the country, you must now vote for Hillary Clinton no matter what, because otherwise we'll have Donald Trump as president. And that's what you're saying, John. You know, like, that's going to become the refrain now. That was the refrain to some extent then, but 6 million fewer Democrats voted in 2016.
And there's the election right there.
Yeah, and that was the election then voted in 2012.
And especially thinking about what were the decisive states for Donald Trump's victory, right? Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio. You know, states where Sanders is very, very popular, but were basically ignored by the Hillary Clinton campaign because, you know, they thought that it was in the bag, right? There was no way that they could possibly lose. I was just thinking about the, you know, fact that Bernie Sanders nominated Hillary Clinton at the campaign and at the convention. And also following that, he campaigned really, really aggressively for her. I mean, he did like really above and beyond the number of campaign events that he would have to do. And I think that indicates that, you know, his goal, right, Bernie Sanders, the individual, which is different than Bernie Sanders, how he's viewed by his supporters. But, you know, Bernie Sanders, the individual, wants to be sort of the loyal opposition within the Democratic Party, advocating for the views that used to, you know, be the dominant views of the Democratic Party during the sort of FDR, New Deal, Lyndon Johnson, Great Society phase of it, right? That's sort of the wing of politics that he wants to bring back. However, you know, the 600,000 people who signed up in 24 hours, right, the millions of people who are going to follow them, what they are inspired by and why they are Bernie Sanders supporters is because they want a fundamental change in society where it's not just, you know, a group, you know, like Bernie Sanders says, the billionaire class gobbling up all the wealth and all the power and committing these horrible injustices on people. You know, that's what this is fundamentally about. Changing the balance of power in society. Can that be done in the Democratic Party? I think absolutely not. But is there really important energy around this? I think the answer is absolutely yes.
This is the dilemma of dilemmas for the U.S. left, Jim Kavanaugh.
Yeah, no, this is clearly, look, it's a principle. You can take a position that I'm going to vote for the Democrat, whoever that is, because we have to get rid. That's a position, okay? I can understand that position. And that is Bernie Sanders' position at the end of the day, I think, okay? But there are a lot of people in the country now, a lot of people, I'm one of them, but there, thanks to Bernie Sanders, there are a lot more who are saying, no, I want to see the program. I want to see what we're actually going to do to break, as Walter said, the stranglehold of the billionaire class on the society. Not just, you know, that involves empower, involves new modes of political empowerment. It's not just we're going to ask them for some more money to help us along a little bit more, noblesse oblige capitalism. We got to take control of the society in a different way. Things are at an impasse that requires much more radical change than just let's invoke the name of FDR or let's go back to Lyndon Johnson. So there are a lot of people who feel that way. And there are a lot of people who feel, I'm not going to go along with it. American imperialism in Latin America or in Syria or in Iran. And what are we going to say about that? Lyndon Johnson got killed because of Vietnam. You know, he had anti-poverty programs, but you can't have this progressive except imperialism. The Democratic Party is going to be riven by fights about Israel and imperialism and anti-Semitism and Palestinian. This is all going to come out. And if you try and stop this from happening in order to defeat Trump, it's not going to work. Too many people are going to say, I see what's going on here. This is the old line. This is, you know, let's all get together to elect another centrist. And nothing's going to change. And that's correct. So I don't know, you know, it's going to be a heck of a fight this time, because Trump is such a kind of caricature, easily caricaturist evil figure, you know, and he is a bad character. But the policies that the Democrats, the Democratic Party, you know, you're supporting this attack on Venezuela, that's not good. That's not something you just say, oh, okay, we'll forget about that. You know what I mean? And if you're saying, oh, you're backing away from Medicare for All now because we can't afford it, what are you talking about? We're going back 10 years. We can't have this. And there's a lot of people who are going to say this. So the Democratic Party it's a problem for the Democratic Party. It's a problem for American politics. And at some point or another, something has to break within the Democratic Party and within the way in which American politics is organized around the Democratic Party. But I don't know how that's going to happen. I really don't. And Bernie Sanders is going to try and prevent it from happening.
That was the voice of Jim Kavanaugh. We're talking to Jim Kavanaugh and Walter Smolarek in this segment of Loud and Clear called The Week in Review. And we're talking about Bernie Sanders, the Bernie Sanders 2020 campaign, the reaction from the Democratic Party, what's likely to happen. Clearly, Bernie Sanders is the front runner right now amongst the Democrats. I don't believe, and again, even though the math lends itself to Bernie Sanders because he stands out among the big field,
right?
I still don't think he's likely to get the nomination because there will be so much media attack against him.
I agree.
I mean,
and you can't trust the Democratic National Committee.
It's impossible. I'm going to say it's impossible for him to get the nomination, and I think he knows it. I mean, I hope he knows it.
Wait a second. We have to mark. We're marking down all the significant predictions, Jim. So Jim Kavanaugh has now today, February 22nd, 2019, predicted he absolutely can't win the nomination. We're going to ask you about it, Jim, later. Either you're going to look really, really good, sagacious, or the opposite. Anyway, I want to just go back again to where we are with all of this. Bernie Sanders, if you think about his campaign and look for historical reference points, we keep mentioning LBJ or FDR. There's another point of reference, historical reference, and that is the Jesse Jackson political presidential bids of 1984 and 1988. Jackson was associated with the Black Civil Rights Movement. When he ran in 84, he was running against the Democratic Party establishment on the basis of taking the struggle for empowerment and Black representation into the Democratic Party establishment. But he also adopted what was basically a class program. And it was a program that was very, very similar, in fact, to Bernie Sanders' platform. And he created something called the Rainbow Coalition. Now, Jesse Jackson didn't have to emphasize the issue of race or racism in America, because he was actually asking voters, Latino, Black, but also white voters, to vote for him. And he was a leading figure in the Black movement. So for white working class people, including in Michigan, in West Virginia, in communities where there were either no Black people or very few Black people, just voting for Jesse Jackson was an inherently sort of anti-racist step, right? And I traveled some with the Jackson campaign during those years, and they would roll into these all-white areas like mining towns in West Virginia or in Michigan or in parts of Maryland, and these mainly white crowds of workers would come out and chant, "Run, Jesse, run," because Jackson had an anti-corporate platform. He was already going to be an anti-racist candidate because he was a leader of the Black movement. Bernie Sanders does not have that part of the platform, because as an older white politician from a mainly white state in Vermont, and someone who, while very, very progressive on the issues of racism, has not been historically associated with the Black community struggle against racism and police violence and so on and so forth. He was part of civil rights demonstrations when he was younger, but that's not his bag. It seems to me that it's key, would be absolutely key for Bernie Sanders to be able to get substantial support from within the Black community. That was very hard at first in the first go round in 2016, because Hillary Clinton had such a strong base within the Democratic Party. Is there going to be a difference this time, Walter? You were involved in watching and active during both campaigns.
Yeah, it's very important. I mean, the other demographic thing to note about Bernie Sanders' base of support is that it's overwhelmingly young, right? I mean, everybody is like teenagers or in their 20s pretty much when you go to one of these rallies. But, I mean, you've got to think about, and it's absolutely right that they're also overwhelmingly white crowds. I mean, I went, you know, to talk to a lot of people who were, you know, waiting in line. I remember in Philadelphia, there was like lines. It was literally like three or four blocks long lines of people, right, waiting to get into this Bernie Sanders rally. And so I was talking with a lot of people, and it was mostly white. And I think that, you know, the profound economic crisis that happened in 2008 and sort of the run up to that, right, you know, all of these like bit by bit, you know, eating away erosion of people's standards of living, you know, it hit young people like really hard because you weren't sort of able to get into the job market and sort of assert yourself. But of course, young people is like a very broad term, right? I mean, there's tons and tons of subdivisions within that, even though there's sort of this common experience of economic disenfranchisement. So, for instance, for Black youth as opposed to white youth, you know, the threat of being locked up for nothing by the police and being sent to prison for years and years is much, 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 much higher, right? You know, for Latino youth, right? I mean, it's much more likely that, you know, the racist policies of the Trump administration, the anti-immigrant policies of all the administrations going back will, you know, affect you more deeply. And so I think that, you know, if the Sanders campaign is able to incorporate all of these demands in a much more profound way, right, like really get to the grassroots organizers in these communities, build alliances, that's going to be decisive to making their base one that's capable of carrying out a profound change or being the catalyst for profound change in a society like the United States that's been marked by the most brutal and violent and vicious racism perhaps of any society on earth.
I want to turn to another issue. Time is going fast here. Donald Trump said the U.S. is leaving Syria, and James Mattis resigned the next day, Secretary of Defense. Now this week, and we're talking about the news this week, just yesterday, the administration announced that the U.S. is leaving 200 troops in Syria, again, partly as a ploy to keep other, quote, allied powers in Syria. They don't want to stay and have their people be killed while the U.S. is leaving. But I want to talk about what, if anything, the residue of 200 troops in Syria might mean and what would be, if it has any significance at all militarily, what that might be. Jim, go ahead.
Well, first of all, I think it's kind of impossible that they'd just be 200 troops. You know that they're going to be 200 acknowledged troops. There's going to be at least probably the same number around for support and logistics, whatever. So, you know, we've got to take that number with a big grain of salt. But even if it's 200 troops, you know, the only reason to do that, the only effect they're not going to affect the fighting that much. Are they there for some kind of tripwire? If someone attacks the Americans, they can then relaunch an attack on Assad. They're there to, as far as I'm concerned, to assert the United States' right to have troops in the world anywhere it wants. And it's kind of crazy. And again, it's blatant imperialism. The United States has no right to have any troops anywhere in the territory of Syria without the permission of the Syrian government. And what they're there is to say, we don't recognize that, the authority of the Syrian government, and we are asserting our own authority over Syrian territory. And we're going to be there as a little redoubt that from which we might act again within Syrian territory against the Syrian government.
Walter, I think they are a tripwire. I think those troops are a trigger so that if they stand, say, between the Syrian Democratic Forces, the Kurds, and the Turkish military, or between the Syrian Democratic Forces and the Syrian Arab Army, which is the Syrian government, on Syrian territory, if either side starts to move towards those positions, they move towards the American troops, and then that becomes the pretext for the U.S. to launch big, massive airstrikes. And we've seen this happen. So it's a way of having a low cost, low visibility, and low risk sort of intervention designed to retain the sort of the breakup of Syria. In other words, the partitioning of Syria. Anyway, what do you think?
I agree that that's their goal. The U.S. government, I think, concluded several years ago that the overthrow of the government in Damascus, the overthrow of the Assad government, was not on the cards. They would prefer that option. They tried hard to make that happen, but it just wasn't realistic anymore. And so, well, okay, plan B is that we can carve up little parts of Syria, right? I mean, the area to the east of the Euphrates River, which is controlled by the Syrian Democratic Forces. That's, you know, a key U.S. ally. You know, the Syrian Democratic Forces may switch sides now, but, you know, that remains to be seen. And so, right, they can at least have a chunk of Syria. They can at least hobble Syria and make it, you know, less assertive on the regional and international stage, you know, challenging U.S. interests. So the other piece of this, I think, is that the fact that it's such a small number, it feels like a compromise, too, to me, between people in the Pentagon who are opposed to any type of withdrawal, right, who probably would prefer to even up the U.S. troop presence in Syria as it enters this important political stage in the conflict where the different sides are sort of negotiating what the shape of post-war Syria will be. And, you know, Donald Trump actually as an individual, right, who, you know, even though he overall, if you look at his record, is absolutely, you know, this imperialist warmonger, but for very narrow, I would say, electoral reasons, want to withdraw troops from Syria. This feels like a compromise between those two positions to me.
Let's turn to another issue. Time is going short. We have about 3 minutes left. Another teacher strike. It started yesterday in Oakland. The L.A. teachers won. The Oakland teachers are now out. West Virginia teachers went on a short strike. They were on strike. They started this teacher strike movement ball rolling. They went on strike and very short-lived, but they won right away again this week because they were protesting the allocation of public funds for charter schools. Jim Kavanaugh, it's the revival of the labor movement. More days were lost, or not more days, more people were on strike than any time last year than since 1987. But it's a new labor movement. It's teachers. And it's women. Women are leading the revival of the labor movement vis-a-vis these teacher strikes. Really something.
Yeah, these teacher strikes are fabulous. I mean, there was a hint of this a few years back with the Chicago teacher strike. And now you're seeing it, you know, the West Virginia, red state, blah, blah, blah. No, they have their material interests. They went out and they fought and they win. California, this is teachers, not university professors, teachers in public schools. And it's great stuff to see this. But, you know, there are other things. One of the things that's interesting to me was the labor movement also reared its beautiful head in the shutdown, because everybody's giving Nancy Pelosi props for ending the shutdown. It was the air traffic controllers. And the flight attendants union said, they were calling for a general strike to end the shutdown. And they learned very quickly that air traffic controllers go on strike, mechanics go on strike, a strike anywhere, any essential industry in the country, you'll end the shutdown in 3 days.
Walter, if the bosses don't come to work, nobody cares. But if the flight attendants, air traffic controllers, or teachers don't come to work, well, guess what? Everybody notices.
Yeah, people absolutely notice. And the same could be said, like Jim was saying, in any major industry. I mean, think about, you know, truck drivers, think about people who make public transportation operate. You know, the workers really do have the power because they do the work. It's as simple as that.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. That was the voice of Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show, Loud and Clear. We were also joined by Jim Kavanaugh. Jim is the editor of thepolemicist.net. His most recent article is The Siege of Venezuela and the Travails of Empire. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day in the Washington, D.C. area, Monday through Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM. You can hear us at sputniknews.com, or you can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.